This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
Our third speaker in this session is Tony Barter, who's known for a lovely paper called Mr. Darwin's Shooters on Natural Selection and the Naturalising of Genocide. He comes to Darwin from German history and Australian history, and he's going to speak to us today on Darwin and social Darwinism, the political use and abuse of natural selection. Thanks, Tony.
Well, I've drawn the short straw, I'm afraid. It falls to me to look at this great man, so kindly, thoughtful, considerate of others, and to suggest there were elements in his writing, not least in The Origin, that stored up terrible trouble for mankind. So a book that changed the world, but not always for the better. And speaking of short, it's come up a few times already today. I mean, it's rather extraordinary, isn't it? We're commemorating this 150 years or 200 years on the work of a man who thought in millennia, in eons, you see, in huge spans of time. And I'm going to suggest that it's in this blink and in this incredible speeding up that the trouble occurred, because it then became a question of superseding natural selection and making unnatural selection much more important and much more dangerous. So Darwin was born into this world in which everything was speeding up, in which human capacities were increasing so that a relatively small section of humanity, that residing in Europe, could claim this global authority and global spread. And that, of course, is what this bucket full of men on the Beagle was all about. It was about man's ability to dominate nature, that ascent of man, which, remember, Bronowski told us about, was revolutionary stuff, the scientific revolution, the agricultural revolution, the industrial revolution, and the revolution of imposing a European view on the world. And that's what Darwin came out of, and that is how I'm suggesting, and I'm not the only one by a long way, that social Darwinism wasn't added on after Darwin and The Origin. It's right there in Darwin. He didn't invent it, but it helped invent him. Now, Australia actually played an important part here. We've had a couple of suggestions of this already. Barry dealt with this very well in an article of his some years ago. And I would even suggest that there are elements in this Australian encounter which are just about as important as those Galapagos finches. Darwin didn't spend all his time getting seasick, of course. He spent a lot of time on the South American continent. And it was there that he encountered a man who called himself General Rosas. And he was a cattle rancher, but he served as governor of Buenos Aires. And he was engaged in what Darwin recognized at the time as a mission to exterminate the Indians. This is Darwin. Some 112 women and children and men were nearly all taken or killed. Very few escaped. The soldiers pursue and sabre every man. Like wild animals, however, they fight to the last instant. And when he asks about why particularly kill the women, any women who appeared above 20 years old, why they're massacred in cold blood, I venture to say this appeared rather inhuman. He answered me, "What can be done? They breed so." Well, as I've said elsewhere, it's the sadly familiar language of genocide. To the perpetrators, Darwin noticed the killing was reasonable and even moral in the larger scheme of things. Civilization decreed the sacrifice of barbarians who stood in its way. In Australia, it wasn't very different. Darwin pondered over the specific causes of the Aborigines' disappearance: disease, drink, a sharp decline in births. He commented, and I think you can find the full quotation in Frank's book, on some mysterious agency generally at work. Wherever the European has trod, death seems to pursue the Aboriginal. And a further reflection. The varieties of man seem to act in each other in the same way as different species of animals, the strong always extirpating the weaker. The language is important, not least because it reinforces our recognition that Darwin didn't draw his theory only from beetles and finches. The survival of the fittest, and the phrase was, of course, invented not by Darwin but by Herbert Spencer, was already there. Human history was there at the birth of the theory. And it was there in this unprecedented onslaught of colonization, and that became a key concept in the origin. In fact, only on the radio this morning I heard about the colonization of magpies in Canberra. Did you hear that? And might follow Melbourne, where we see very few little fairy wrens in the gardens because the magpies have taken over. This analogy appealed to Darwin. And he also noticed that where varieties are similar, then, of course, the competition is at its most intense and most ruthless. So when, in Australia, hunting grounds were taken over by sheep and cattle, species carried round the world by no natural process at all, Darwin understood that this was all part of farming, investment, the movement of capital, civilization in short, and he couldn't see how the Aborigines he saw around Sydney could survive this kind of onslaught. Uncivilized indigenous peoples, he thought, would probably have to go. There had been a necessity, Darwin's word, to round up the indigenous people of Tasmania. And, as we've heard, who could not feel pride and satisfaction about this grand centre of civilization arising in the Southern Hemisphere? Well, I'll have to return to colonization a little later. Another development was taking place and gathered much more pace after the origin. It won't have escaped anyone here, and we've had references to it, that the first chapters of the origin aren't about natural selection at all. Darwin talked about variation under domestication, and it's a good ploy, you know, to get to his audience. They weren't just interested in pigeons as he was, but in sheep and dogs, more productive plants. Modification in nature. And so the beginning of the book is man's power of selection. There it is, right at the start, unnatural selection. Am I making too much of this? I mean, for gooseberries, dogs or pigeons, those are three of Darwin's favourites, it mattered a lot. But for humans? Well, it certainly led away from evolution, didn't it, towards intervention. And there it was that Darwin's cousin, Francis Galton, invented something he called eugenics, the science of breeding better humans. It was widely embraced as a benign outgrowth of the progressive environment, but it didn't stay benign. This should hardly have surprised Darwin, the researcher into mutation. Darwin's most adventurous foray into social policy is in The Descent of Man, his later book. And he makes this reflection. We civilized men do our utmost to check the process of elimination. We build asylums for the imbecile, the maimed and the sick. We institute poor laws, and our medical men exert their utmost skill to save the life of everyone to the last moment. Well, thank goodness. But thus, the weak members of society propagate their kind. No one who has attended to the breeding of domestic animals will doubt that this must be highly injurious to the race of man. Well, Darwin must have known that eugenics was against his most fundamental beliefs. One of these was the old saying, nature does not make leaps. Everything happens in small increments. Eugenics was some distance from what Darwin called the one general law leading to the advancement of all organic beings, namely multiply, vary, let the strongest live and the weakest die. There's no principle in Darwin that you kill off what was later called life unworthy of life, no so-called euthanasia. The furthest he would go, not wanting to betray what was very important to him, the noblest part of our nature, was a hope that the weaker and the inferior members of society and the poor perhaps not marry so freely. However, when Galton's obsession with inherited characteristics swept the world, it would inspire some tragic interventions. There'd be much citing of Galton's dictum: what nature does blindly, slowly, and ruthlessly, man may do providently, quickly, and kindly. Well, in Australia, as we've had occasion to reflect in the last year, ruthlessness and kindness were hard to separate. For a short, sad account of what eugenics meant in this country, I'd recommend Henry Reynolds' newer book called Nowhere People. It has the subtitle, How International Race Thinking Shaped Australia's Identity. It tells the story, the sorry story, of the human abuse we've only just said sorry for. The last section is on stolen children. The earlier parts of the book trace how Darwinian ideas from white progressive England coalesced with homegrown settler attitudes to black people considered the least progressed of all humanity. And as for our own humanity, the record is clear. Australians generally supported a prejudice that black or mixed-race children were inferior, that paler ones might be assimilated into white society, and important officials made statements. You can hear one of them in Australia out of the mouth of Bruce Spence, who still looks much like Stork, made statements that could have been uttered in Nazi Germany, and the statements justified cruel actions. It was early in the removal policy, after a 1905 law in Western Australia, that James Isdell said, "I wouldn't hesitate for a moment to separate any half-caste from its Aboriginal mother. No matter how frantic her grief might be at the time, they soon forget their offspring." But the statement making the whole rationale clear and the mad ambition of the policy was made by A.O. Neville, a long-serving protector in Western Australia, at a Canberra conference here in 1937. Are we going to have a population of 1 million blacks in the Commonwealth, or are we going to merge them in our white community and eventually forget that there were any Aborigines in Australia? This was 1937, 2 years after the Nuremberg Laws. Well, the Nazi policy was biological separation. Here it was biological absorption. Both policies were travesties of Darwin, though not perhaps of Galton. What about America? Eugenics very big there, perhaps bigger than anywhere else. As in Germany, racial mixing was seen as a threat, allied with mental feebleness and the threat of the poor to civilized society. But American optimism was also irrepressible. We've been hearing more about it this week. Surely the triumphs of capital, the amassing of wealth by a few, the rising living standard of many, these were all proofs of social Darwinism in action. So America became the home of rugged individualism, freedom in everything. I think Don Watson's very good on this. And reading Darwin in a way that seemed to militate against the welfare state. Herbert Spencer was huge. So was a man called William Graham Sumner. And a glowing disciple of his was Andrew Carnegie. It's been argued that Darwin himself was never as hard-hearted as some of his remarks implied, or so set on ruthless struggle. And certainly he did talk about animals aiding each other and cooperation, not selfishness, often being the key to survival. And these suggestions were taken up by socialists, and most notably by Kropotkin in a book called Mutual Aid. as we ruefully keep recalling capitalist competition won out. And so did imperialist competition. And when, decades after Darwin was laid to rest in Westminster Abbey, there was a great war amongst the European powers, one casualty of that war was Adolf Hitler. It made him, as Himmler also liked to say, hard. Hart wie Kruppstahl, hard as steel. Nature was merciless, and he had seen with his own eyes what happened in a test where ruthless will was required to win out. It was a principle that Hitler reiterated throughout his own terrible carnage. Germans had not proved themselves, he said right at the end, and didn't deserve even the most primitive further existence. Well, Hitler may never have read Darwin directly. I'm pretty sure he didn't. But here we should face up to it was the original Darwinism. When two races meet, they act precisely like two species of animals. They fight, eat each other, bring diseases to each other, but then comes the deadly struggle, namely, which have the best fitted organization or instincts, or intellect in man, to gain the day. Darwin was already writing that in his notebook in 1838. And there are many similar passages in his later book, The Descent of Man, and of course, we have just seen the subtitle of The Origin, The Preservation of Favored Races in the Struggle for Life. These words stored up much tragedy. But I don't think these sort of potential slogans were really the problem. It was, I think, a kind of intellectual lapse on Darwin's part, perhaps against his own better judgment, because he repeatedly said he wasn't specially qualified to comment on human affairs, politics and the like. But it was recognized in his time and all the time later that humanity now had these enormous capacities to do great violence and to make great changes in a very short time. And if Hitler was the most catastrophic, it was in part because he felt so strongly he had such a very short time to undertake his great colonizing work for that Aryan race, which I learned today was celebrated in Australia. So the biological premises of Nazi racism are notorious. But I think still struggling for recognition is the depth to which that planting and supplanting ideology of colonization figured in Nazism. Hitler was very clear about it all in his mealtime conversations during the war. You can read this in his books called Hitler's Table Talk. This is about the Russians. Well, by instinct, the Russian doesn't incline towards a higher degree of society. If anyone asks us where we obtain the right to extend the Germanic space to the East, we reply that, for a nation, the awareness of what she represents carries this right with it. We have only one duty, to Germanize this country by the immigration of Germans and to look upon the natives of redskins. It should be a matter of complete indifference to us how this bread is grown that was won by the sword. When we eat wheat from Canada, we don't think about the despoiled Indians. And it's this kind of hardness which seems to connect all too readily with those original Darwinian principles. In the end, I come back to this being not even a minute on Darwin's natural history scale. But adaptation still sits there. And, of course, now we are also left with the question how we are going to respond in a very short time and adapt to the changes that mankind has itself wrought. So it's an urgent matter of learning from history as well as nature, and we alone among the evolved species will have to decide if nature as we now know it survives. Thank you.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.